Thank you. Hello and good evening. You know, it's bad enough when you interview someone who's 94 who is sharper than you are. And it's even worse when they have a better golf game than you do. That was the case when I went to Houston to talk to Jackie Burke Jr. Jackie was one of those people that was destined to do great things in golf. He grew up around legends of the game with names like Demerit, Pinnick, and Zaharias. And he ran around Hollywood with Hope, Crosby, and Frank Sinatra. And somehow, he found time to squeeze in a career that saw him win a green jacket and a PGA championship. He also accumulated one of the greatest records in Ryder Cup history. Joined the Marines during World War II, Semper Fi. And well, you know, you get the picture. He's done everything. He even sat down with me for an interview. You don't have to believe me. Just watch.
I joined Jackie in Houston on his home turf, where he reserved a special spot for us in the men's locker room.
Jackie, thank you for having me here at Champions here in Houston. John Joseph Burke, how did you get Jackie?
You got me.
Really?
I mean, how do you get Bob out of Robert, you know?
Were you always Jackie?
I was always Jackie.
You're sharp as a razor.
Yeah. If you get old, I'd suggest you get old in super condition.
Yeah.
And you need 35-year-old conditioning at 94.
Yeah.
Are you ready to go?
I'm not, and I think you're in better shape than I am.
Well, we're going to send you to the gym.
Well, you see, look at these. Here, see those two?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've got your ears covered up, that doesn't show.
Well, yes, I've got longer hair, you know, but I've got to wear the hearing aids as well. In fact, I went to the grocery store just the other day, and I had to go and buy a pair of reading glasses so that I could find the batteries for my hearing aid.
Oh, God.
You know, you're definitely in better shape than I am.
You need the right humor.
Let's play some story association here. I'll name a person, and you can tell me what they remind you of. Ben Hogan.
One day I was playing golf in Phoenix. I shot a 69, and that's a good number at Phoenix Country Club. And Hogan shot a 66, and I was going to the parking lot to get in the car to go to the motel. I said, what are you thinking about? I mean, the man shot 66, and he's practicing. So I went down to watch him, and he was dealing with these two fingers. He wanted to practice with them real light. He was hitting it, just striping it perfect. So the next day, I saw he shot a 69 too. And I said, how did the two fingers go? He said, they never got to the first tee.
He was pretty mysterious though, wasn't he? You know, he wouldn't tell people what the secret was or what he was working on a lot of the time.
No, he was pretty much of a loner. Well, golf makes you that way sometimes.
Yeah.
You just can't be too big. You're out broadcasting. How do you do it and everything?
Hey, tell me a little bit about Sam Snead.
Sam was a guy that birdied the first hole more times than anybody alive. He teed off trying to birdie the first hole, where most people are trying to tee off and take their time about getting a birdie, not him.
Okay, Babe Zaharias.
Babe Zaharias used to take lessons from my dad. He would teach her. And then I'd get to play with her. And she would say to me, come on, little Jackie, I'm going to beat your butt out here today. And the day that I out-hit Babe Zaharias was my day of fame and fortune.
You drove it past her?
I drove it past her, and I'd never done that before. That was my first time to hit it past her. I was about 13, 14, something like that.
Tell me a little bit about your friendship with Bing Crosby.
He had the softest touch that I've ever seen in golf. I didn't know him. Demerit took me out to California when I was like 18 years old, before the war. And I met Bing at Paramount. And then later on during the war, he knew a Colonel Ritterhoff in San Diego. And he called Colonel Ritterhoff to see if I could play with him at Rancho Santa Fe, a club there. I had a lieutenant named Kennedy, linebacker for Notre Dame. So Colonel Ritterhoff called him and said, there'll be a car down for PFC Burke.
Yeah.
And he said, he's going to play with Bing Crosby. So he came in to where I was in there. He said, your car is waiting on you for golf. When I saw Bing, I said, Bing, don't ever call me on that base, man. Now, that guy's going to give me every detail that he doesn't want to do the rest of my life.
Well, Jackie, you have outlived everyone we've spoken about so far. And, of course, the most recent loss that we've had was Arnold Palmer. Tell me a little bit about Arnold.
I always thought he was going to be good. Anyway, one time at Augusta, we were playing a match out there for a few dollars. Ben and I did. We won some money from Arnold and his partner. And he said, how did this guy get in the Masters with that swing?
Ben Hogan?
Ben said that.
Said this, yeah.
Look, the reason they got him in Augusta so he could win it four times.
And, of course, Byron Nelson.
He was a real good player. My dad liked him. He was with this group with that grip. Byron was, too, because they all liked that grip.
Yeah.
They all liked that.
Well, he didn't really play for very long either, did he? He just went back to the farm and retired.
He won so many tournaments during the war, you lose your intensity.
Yeah.
I mean, you get on top of the mountain, but if you come down, you lose the intensity. You get back up on the mountain.
You know, I'm looking around the locker room here at Champions, all these black and white photographs of you played in such a wonderful era. And I know the great friend of yours and a partner here at Champions was Jimmy Demerit. If there was one player that I would love to have known, I think it might have been Jimmy Demerit. He was supposed to be such a character.
Jimmy didn't know whether he wanted to be a movie star or a golfer. You know, he could sing, and he'd sing at the drop of a hat.
Really?
And he'd sing with Phil Harris down at the old Hollywood Club in Galveston, Texas.
I'm guessing there may have been some alcoholic beverages involved in that episode with Phil Harris and a few of those characters.
On our bar up here, we've got a plaque where Demerit used to have his cocktail.
Is there a seatbelt on the bar stool?
Yes.
Your first win was in Harlingen, Texas. What do you remember about the, you know, because that's a milestone, getting your first.
The 18th hole is a par 5. And my ball was laying in just dirt. And I knew my driver had some loft on it. And I took my driver, and the wind was blowing so hard, I knew I could just top it farther than I could hit a 4-wood or something. So how that ball stayed in the air, I'll never know, and went that close to the flag.
Driver from a dirty lie?
And I won the tournament. It was a miracle. But I think when you're winning, it's pretty much God's on the shaft up here somewhere.
Yeah. Well, in 1950, you win Bing's tournament, the old clam bake.
I was traveling with Demerit, and we were living at Lawson Little's house.
Yeah?
He comes out on the ropes out there, and he said, why don't you go in and sign for your 81, and let's get on down the road. I said, I'm even par. And he said, well, you're tied for the lead.
Of course, there's no scoreboard, so you didn't know?
Nothing.
Until then?
I didn't know anything. And I got the ball on the green and two-putted. I said, now you're going to have to stay here while I go down and get Bing's check. So we had to spend the night again with Lawson Little because I won the tournament.
In the 55 PGA Championship, you played a 9-hour match against Dr. Cary Middlecoff.
Middlecoff and I are in this match, and I'm one up on him, and we're coming down to the finishing hole.
And this is a 36-hole match?
36-hole match. I just hit a drive down there, and I'm going to put it on the green and hope I could wedge it up there somewhere. He was in rough over there, and it was teed up real high. He took a driver and knocked it on the green. I couldn't believe it. And we went to 18. I was one up, and I just needed to tie the hole to win the PGA. I played up and two-putted and got my 4. He's back there. He sat on his bag and lit a cigarette and changed his glove. And Chick Harbert was the pro. He said, why don't you call him for holding up play, man? I said, well, if he can make that putt, you know, I want us to be here and bear witness to that. It went right in the center of the hole from 30 feet downhill. And I've never seen that done before. And then we'd go out and play 18 holes, playoff. He beat me in the playoff.
Yeah, he got you in 55.
Right.
But you got them all in 56.
Mm.
You earned a great deal of respect from it and respect from the members back at the golf course.
The club, right. I did. And then I worked for McGregor Company, and they hired me to play on the tour. They gave me, I think, $5,000 or $6,000 a year.
That was a pretty good contract.
Yeah, and then I got a shirt deal with Munsingwear.
Yeah.
And they gave me some money. So I had enough money to get started on the tour. I didn't know how I was going to come out, but I played it for about 10 years.
In 1956, you'd already had a number of top 10 starts when you came to Augusta. But you started on Sunday, 8 shots behind Ken Venturi. I spoke to Ken Venturi about this. He told me that it was maybe the worst conditions he ever played in.
The last day was pouring down rain, and it was just a day that I told Doug Ford, I was standing on the putting green, I said, I'll take 77 and take these shoes off. He said, I'll take 78, because he was next to me. I knew I couldn't get on the first hole in two. I knew good and well I couldn't.
Yeah.
With anything in my bag, the wind was so hard. I knew if I could get in the bunker, I could get it out pretty close. So I got in the bunker, and I got up and down for a par. The second hole, the par five hole, I've never been on it with anything. I went over the green with a 5-iron.
It was blowing that hard?
See, number four, I hit a driver and a wedge. That's a par three. And you know, how do you think you're planning for this? You know, you've got this under control. Well, I said, man, I'm out of control. Not a question of having control. I remember the 16th green, I was short because I'm going dead into the wind. I think I hit a 4-iron, and I was short. I had to putt the pins on the left like they always put it. That hill is there. And I saw a guy in a yellow sweater up there, and I putted up at him and hoped that the ball would just fall off that hill down there. It fell off to about 6 feet, and I made that. Suchek said to me, he said, man, you're in good shape. These people are falling dead back there. I didn't particularly need that. And I got a shot, and I put it on the left part of the green. I had about a 30-foot putt. But the sand had blown out of the sand trap on the green. And I said, this is going to be fast, you know, this sand up here. But I just sort of forgot that it's going uphill. And so I hit this putt, and I said, oh, man, that's halfway. It went in. And I'm thinking I did everything wrong, and it went in. So now I'm one under. And we go up to get to the last hole, and Suchek hits me on the back, which I had to recover from before I teed off.
He hits you on the back with what?
Good going, man.
Oh, right.
And I thought, So I went over to the tee, and I said, get the ball in the fairway. I got the ball in the fairway, and the wind is blowing so hard across that green, it blew me into the sand trap. I've been in a lot of sand traps, and so I was going to put it up above the hill and hopefully that it would roll back down like it does a lot of times. I got it out exactly and it stayed there. I thought, there's no way that thing can stay there.
So now you're coming downwind?
Now I'm coming downhill and I marked it. And I've never asked a caddy for a time if he had 4 wristwatches on. So I went up there and I said, Pappy, it's inside the hole, isn't it? He said, yeah, man, just cruise her on in there. And I toe-putted that thing. I put it right on the toe, and I could see my line, and I just started it about that far on my line and just was hoping that it would run the rest of the way, and it went in. When I made the putt, Suchek hit me one more time.
Yeah.
And I couldn't stand many more holes with Suchek.
With Suchek slapping you on the back?
Yeah.
Most of the field would warm up, you know, before a round. But on that Sunday at Augusta, you went to church, and you only had 15 minutes to warm up.
Right.
You think that had something to do with it?
It did, and I gave something to the collection.
That's what I call divine intervention. And just a few months later, Jackie found himself in the final match of the 1956 PGA Championship.
When we played in Boston, I beat Ted Kroll in the finals.
This is when the PGA was match play event?
Match play.
You were an amazing match player. You won 8 matches in a row.
Right.
I mean, you had to win the PGA Championship, right?
I'm telling you that it's just one miracle after the other.
I'm not sure if it was so miraculous. You know, I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit. I mean, you made some pretty clutch putts and hit some great shots at the right time. I mean, that's just a sign of a great player. Well, a time for the famous rapid fire segment here, Jackie. A quick answers to my stupid questions. Somebody start a clock somewhere. Favorite hole at Augusta?
My favorite hole is the one I'm on.
Who's the better player, Bing Crosby or Bob Hope?
Bing Crosby. He played in the amateur.
Yeah. I played with Bob Hope once. He hit it sideways. What defending champion served the best dinner at the Masters?
It was terrible food.
That's a good answer. What's the best menu item in the dining room here at Champions?
Pecan chicken salad.
Sounds Texas to me. Do you still do a one-on-one interview with each new member of the club?
I do.
Terrifying. Match play or stroke play?
Match play.
You like match play, don't you? Yeah, you were good at it. Have you shot your age?
I think I can shoot 94.
Yeah?
I can hit the ball, but I can't see it.
Well, if you can't see, then it doesn't really matter because people could tell you that you shot 94 and you wouldn't know.
Yeah, that's right.
What's your favorite golf course, you know, other than this one?
I've got a lot of them, but Cypress Point I like.
Beautiful walk. Toughest competitor you ever played against?
I guess Snead.
Who had the best putting stroke?
Bobby Locke.
Yes, he did. Hooked everything in. All right, that's rapid fire. You win absolutely nothing. Well, you were born into golf, growing up around the game at River Oaks, where your dad was the professional. Now, he was second in the 1920 U.S. Open. He must have been quite a player.
He was a really good player. He was from Philadelphia, and every state he was ever in, he won the championship. He won it here in Texas. He beat DeMeritt for it.
Your partner here,
right,
at and the Champions?
The first seniors event ever the PGA put on, he won it. He was a simple teacher and a simple type player, and he used to tell me, don't send anybody to the first tee with anything on their mind other than play.
How old were you the first time you broke 70?
Nine.
You were 9 years old?
Mm-hmm.
You were a student at Rice University here in Houston when World War II started, right?
Right.
But you joined the Marines?
We never had any guns, and my dad didn't do any hunting or anything. I never saw a rifle in my whole life, so I knew I was going to have to learn to use a rifle, and I thought the Marines knew more about that than the Army did. Many a day I wished I hadn't thought of that.
You taught other Marines to jump as if they were jumping from an aircraft carrier?
The Japanese were bombing aircraft carriers, and the only way off an aircraft carrier is to jump, and it's 70 feet. So we built a jump school in the Mojave Desert. And my job was to get these pilots off of that platform so they could jump and save their life in case they're on an aircraft carrier. And that water looked like you were jumping in a thimble down there from 70 feet.
It was like a tank?
It was a tank.
Yeah.
And a lot of them didn't want to do that.
I imagine
but
not.
The officer told me to get every one of them off and don't push one of them. So I had to do some talking to talk them into jumping that thing. And a lot of times I had to go with him.
Well, when you came back from your service, and thank you for that, by the way, you wanted to work in the oil fields.
And I'm riding in with Craig Wood, who my dad knew.
Yes.
Into this hotel. He said, what are you going to do? I said, well, if I could shoot this cab driver, I'd drive it. And he said, come on up to my room, because I know where there's a job. So I went up to his room, and he called a guy named Bobby Jacobson at the Hollywood Club in Deal, New Jersey, and got me a job.
And what did that job pay?
Pay?
Yeah.
Nothing. You just had to earn it. You had to teach.
Yeah?
We were teaching for about, I think, about $5 or $6, $7 an hour.
So you're straight out of the Marine Corps. You haven't played golf in how many years?
Four.
And you go straight into teaching?
Right.
Did you know anything about teaching?
I took my dad. I knew what he knew.
Uh-huh.
So I just taught like he did. And I, to this day, still teach pretty much the same way.
It's a pretty simple game, really, but do people make it complicated?
I mean, you put the club down. If you can bring it back there, you're going to play fairly well.
Well, it doesn't get much more simple than that.
Under good friend and Captain Sam Snead, Jackie became a Ryder Cup rookie in 1951. He went undefeated in seven straight matches and was part of four victorious Ryder Cup teams. But as captain in 1957, Jackie hit a roadblock when he had to step in during the singles matches.
Ted Kroll came to me and his butt was raw. I told Di Race I'm going to have to substitute Kroll.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to delve deeper on this. How did this injury occur?
Just walking too much.
Chafing?
Chafing.
Chafing. Been there. Yeah. We used to call it catty ass.
It's painful.
Yes, it is.
I took off my jacket and went out there on that first tee with that guy. He birdied three out of the first four holes, and I never could catch him. So that was the point I lost. We lost the Ryder Cup up there. I'll tell you, two of the players, one of them's wife, took a shoe and was going to hit him over his head, and he put his hand up there, and it split this finger right here. Dick Mayo, who was a good player.
This gets more bizarre.
So
between Ted Kroll's ass and Dick Mayo's hand?
Well, then another guy comes up and knocks on my door and said he wanted to sleep in the room because his wife is raising hell with him.
This is another player?
Another player. I think it was Finsterwall.
He's a beauty.
Yeah.
I would love to have Dyer on the show.
Yeah.
Was the defeat in 57 still in the back of your mind then? And did that erase it, or?
I know how to play in that stuff. I know that you got to be solo out there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a partner. It's like business. You don't want too many partners because too many ideas. Bad enough if we got your idea.
Yeah, oh, I would say so.
I told Sutton to never play Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods.
Yeah.
Because I know that they're going to lean on one another. If Tiger hits it off, now it's too much pressure on Phil. Because they're not playing individually. They're trying to play as a team. And so he didn't listen to me. But Sutton is pretty much like a General Patton. That's Sutton.
Yeah, well, he's from Texas.
Yeah.
I recently had Phil Mickelson on the show, and he said that you revolutionized his idea of putting when you said he had a hole 100 in a row from around the hole. Talk me through that.
Miller Barber sent him down here for me. He said that the guy's a good player, he just needs to be a better putter. So he came down, and I've always made a circle. I put my putter in the cup, and then I put the ball on the end, and I make a circle all the way around the cup. I told Mickelson, I said, I'm going to put this 100 here. When you put 100 in a row in, I'll be in my office. He said, I'll do that right now. I said, start. He missed the fourth ball. But it's not easy, but you chip to that 30 or 40 feet across there to a little bitty hole. Don't ever do that. Putting lines. Do not ever putt cups. Let me show you a grip.
Must see a grip.
Now bend over.
Talk a little bit about some of the lessons that you've given. You've always been a teacher.
One man in New York, I never will forget it, there was a $500 reward if you could stop him from shanking. And so I was up there, and he didn't shank in the fairways. He shanked around the green.
Right.
He just pushed the club into it.
Little shanks?
He loved his pipe. He'd polish his pipe. So one day, I put the pipe on the other side of the ball, and he wouldn't dare hit that pipe, so I cured his shank, and I got the 500. But there was a guy came in the pro shop later on. He said, it doesn't work on long irons.
And he shattered his pipe?
Shattered his pipe, but he was on long irons.
There's an irony in that, because when you shank it, you actually hit it out of the pipe?
Yeah.
Jackie, I've got some photographs here. I'd like to show our viewers them first, like that, and then ask you, who's this little ankle biter?
You think I started early enough?
Yeah, I think you did. I mean, you're half the height of the golf clubs.
Yeah. That was me getting started at River Oaks. Looked like it was a cold day with that hat on.
Yeah. Well, speaking of hats, Semper Fi.
That's one I would question myself if that was a good idea.
Well, you're always a Marine, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Now, here's one of my favorites right there. We got Bobby Jones, You got Dr. Middlecoff, there's you, Clifford Roberts, and is that Kenny?
Venturi.
It's Ken Venturi, yeah.
Right.
1956, the Masters.
Right.
Slipping that green jacket on had to feel pretty good.
That did. To think that you were going to win anything that day.
Yeah.
I mean, caddy, you weren't going to get caddy fee money out of that day.
No, I'm not familiar with... Is that Ed Sullivan?
Ed Sullivan. He put me on his show. He was a member at Wingfoot when I worked up there.
Well, you know, I'm told that Ben Hogan didn't do a lot of smiling, but he enjoyed being with you, evidently.
Yeah, he did. We played a lot of golf.
Yeah?
You know, he built a course between Fort Worth and Dallas, and he wanted me to come up and check it out. So I went up there, and he had an A-frame house, just a little bitty space there, and had a desk in it. I said, you need to find a place to get to where you can sell memberships. And you need to be in the downtown area somewhere. I said, there's going to be some guys from Houston with little black bags that will be coming in and giving you a check for your little time there. But they're going to take over because you've got a big piece of land here and no income.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't hear that.
No.
But that's exactly what happened. Accountants came in. Mm-hmm. And took over the project and left him, I think, with 20 or 30 acres.
In 1957, Jimmy DeMeritt and you decided you would open this club, Champions. Basically, you were at the height of your career.
I was 34.
Yeah.
With three kids, I didn't want to raise them in New York. I couldn't afford it. You can't hardly afford a house up there if you're just a golf pro.
No, you still can't?
This has been a big gamble, but I'm sort of used to that.
And how did the Champions get its name?
From Jack Valenti.
Yeah?
He had an advertising company here, and he worked for Lyndon Baines Johnson as his right-hand man. And I thought he was a takeoff on the Masters, but Valenti named it, and he said that's what it has to be.
So who put up the money?
For the club.
For the club?
We had 500 members sign up for $1,000.
And this is before you move a...
1 ounce of dirt.
Yeah?
And so we started out here... pretty meekly, and then we've just gradually been able to pay our bills. We've never assessed anybody here, mostly because we're not building anything that we can't pay for.
I always say that there's a difference between a golf club and a golf course. There are a lot of golf courses around America where the members don't play with each other. They bring guests.
Right.
Here at Champions and some of the other great clubs, the members play with each other. There's a sense of community.
Everybody here's got a foursome or a fivesome that he's part of. Sometimes there's 8 or 10 in a group, and they meet on certain days, and you always can find a game here. You don't see many people playing by themselves.
Yeah, that's a bad sign. Somebody's playing by themselves.
That elevator's not getting to the top.
Now, somebody was telling me a story, and I'm not sure if this is true. You can't get into Champions if you've a very high handicap.
Now I think it's 14.
I'd be screwed. You're 94 years old, and you're still actively involved in running this club. Is that what keeps you sharp?
Yeah, I think you need to stay doing what you're doing. I think that retirement, you might as well go ahead and make an arrangement for the box, because it ain't going to be long.
Well, Jackie, you have achieved my greatest ambition. You've managed to grow old without growing up.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for spending this time with me.
Thanks to have you here, David.
Thank you. From the earliest steps he took chasing his father around the course to today, when you'll find him on a green giving putting lessons or checking in on his members, Jackie Burke Jr. has lived a life devoted to golf. He didn't build the Champions Club so he could retire. He built it so that he could continue to grow the game he loves. The funny thing is that he still feels like he owes the game, while anyone who knows Jackie and golf realizes that it's the other way around. Okay, that's that. Thanks for watching. You can catch more of me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and we'll see you next time. Good night, everybody. Good night, sweetie.